I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. For about 100 years, life expectancy had been growing in the United States. By 2019, the average American, emphasis on average, could expect to live to be 79 years old. 2 years later, in 2021, average life expectancy had fallen 3 years to 76. It's even worse for Native Americans and Alaska Natives. Their life expectancy dropped 6.5 years in that same time period to 65. That's the average age for the average American back in the 1940s. So what role has the coronavirus pandemic, our patchwork healthcare system, poverty, equity, and access played in falling rates of life expectancy, and what can be done to reverse the trend? Joining us is Ana Diaz-Ruiz. She is Dean and Professor of Epidemiology at Drexel University's Dornsife School of Public Health. She's here with us in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you join us to talk about this important issue.
Thank you for having me.
I was really shocked to read those numbers, that we saw such a dramatic decline in life expectancy in such a short period of time. Are you surprised?
Yes, these are very large numbers. Of course, we expected to see a decline in life expectancy because of what we know about mortality rates for COVID in the United States, which have been extraordinarily high compared to other high-income countries even. But nevertheless, these numbers are quite disturbing. Usually when we have seen changes in life expectancy, they have been in the order of fractions of years. But these are, as you noted, almost 3 years for the whole population and up to 6.5 years for American Indian and Alaska Natives, and also 4 years for Blacks and Hispanics, 2 years for whites and Asian Americans. So quite a disturbing decline in life expectancy.
And across the board, obviously, with some differences between populations.
Yes, very large differences by race and ethnicity with certain groups, particularly, as you noted, Native Americans, Black Americans, and Hispanic Americans experiencing very large declines. And these, you know, to put these in perspective, these numbers are quite shocking compared to what we see in other high-income countries across the 2 years of the pandemic, the first 2 years of the pandemic. If you look at the average across 22 other high-income countries, they saw a decline of 1 year during during the first year, and during the second year of the pandemic, they even saw a recovery. So about a quarter of a year increase in life expectancy. So that really shows that, you know, something quite troubling is going on here. As you noted, you know, this is not only COVID. You know, COVID is a big piece of it. You know, about I think the report says that about 50% is related to COVID during the last year. You know, these numbers are estimates, and, sure, and perhaps, you know, 75% during 2020. But there's a big chunk which is not. It's other causes of death that are also going up. And these include unintentional injuries, overdose deaths, but also traffic-related deaths, chronic liver disease and cirrhosis related to alcoholism, suicides and homicides in some groups too. And
gun-related
deaths and some chronic diseases as well, stroke and other cardiovascular diseases.
So how much do you think then COVID has exposed or shown us the kind of systemic problems we have with our health, but also with our healthcare system?
Yes, certainly what we have seen with COVID is highlighting things that had been going on before, fundamental systemic processes that are driving poor health in the United States. I mean, many of these causes of death that we saw increase, other causes of death, we had seen increases before. This is not new. There have been a couple of reports, actually, from the National Academy of Sciences recently documenting increases in those causes of death, those same causes of death, for middle-aged Americans, so which is quite troubling. And so COVID exposed that, you know, superimposed itself on that and highlighted those issues even further. As you noted, you know, systemic problems, systemic forces that are driving health and health inequities in the United States.
And I do want to pick up on that, but I'm also assuming that people with chronic illnesses were at greater risk for contracting COVID or maybe even dying from COVID itself.
Certainly. I mean, certainly that was one factor that made COVID even worse. I mean, I think the U.S. response to COVID was, you know, nationally, it was chaotic, frankly. I mean, it was fragmented in many ways, chaotic in many ways. I mean, I think local health departments, including our own Philadelphia Health Department, really made valiant and Herculean efforts, really, to implement evidence-based policies. But at the national level, it was chaotic from the point of view of tracking the pandemic, the data, what was really going on, from the point of view of coordinated policy action. You know, our results regarding vaccine uptake are dismal compared to other high-income countries. I mean, about two-thirds of the U.S. population, just a little over two-thirds, has complete vaccination only. In other countries, Chile, for example, has 92% coverage. Brazil, in the 80s. I mean, many other countries did much, much better than the United States.
Do you think it was the so-called anti-vaxxers, or was it the confused messaging, or was it, you know, access to the vaccines itself?
I think it's many factors combined. I think, you know, it was politicized very early on. But I think it also reveals some of these fundamental systemic failures. I mean, we had no established system for distributing vaccines quickly. This is a failure of our healthcare system, frankly. And you know, we have a fragmented also healthcare system in the United States, which is, you know, profit driven and which is, you know, very good at certain things. Mm-hmm. I mean, survival for cancer is outstanding in the United States. But for other things like primary care and prevention, it's not very well organized. But of course, it's not only the healthcare system. There are all these other things, too.
Well, while we're talking about the healthcare system, and you referenced other similar countries to us, I guess we're called a developed country, but you know, sometimes it doesn't even feel that way. But are these countries that do have a healthcare system that is just much more inclusive and provides much more coverage for their people?
It's a combination of things. I mean, it's partly related to the healthcare system, partly related to public health infrastructure, which also in this country has been heavily definanced and really not prioritized, but it's also related to our society and our the way we approach policy in general and our social safe approaches to social safety net and social protections and equity, frankly.
So, if this is where we're at, where do we go? I mean, what steps do we take to try to improve this falling life expectancy rate?
Well, I think, you know, there are a number of factors, right? And I think we have to address all of them simultaneously. And they, you know, from the most, you know, people think about health, they think about the healthcare system first, and that needs to be fixed, the healthcare system, the healthcare delivery system, certainly increasing access, increasing focus on prevention, reducing inefficiencies, increasing coordination. But also, we know, for example, that a large percent of the U.S. population, you know, the pervasively high levels of factors which we know are poor for health, sedentary lifestyles, consumption of ultra-processed foods, gun availability, smoking. But all these things are rooted in environmental and social conditions. They're not just about people's choices. And so, for example, we have a very car-dependent society that reduces active transportation, for example, that reduces physical activity in daily life. We have heavy advertising for processed foods. This influences consumption. It influences norms. Gun availability, you know, suicides is one of the causes that have gone up. Half of suicides are gun-related.
That's right.
And of course, it's a very effective way of committing suicide, you know, so the success rates with guns is very high. And then we have all these other factors that have to do with inequality, with the history of racism in the United States, the historical legacy of that and the continuing impacts of that, and social inequality generally. And that's manifested in housing, in work conditions, in neighborhood conditions, neighborhood investments. So I think this points to the fact that when we think about improving health, we need to think about the impacts of all these policies that are outside healthcare, that all these things that we do for housing, for neighborhood development, for increasing equity, for reducing inequality, for improving conditions at work, for sick leave, for social safety nets, all those things have major health impacts and need to be thought of as health policy.
Yeah, I mean, that is a tall order. We are talking in the poorest large city in the country. Mm-hmm. How much does poverty then affect longevity? quality of life?
It's a fundamental driver. I mean, the CDC report, unfortunately, was not able to report differences by socioeconomic position, income, education, because our data are not very good on that, which is in itself, you know, important. But all these things are entwined. I mean, racism and discrimination interacts with income inequality and social conditions and poverty, and all these things reinforce each other. So these are sort of the fundamental drivers of health and health inequities, and these things, I think, are the reasons why the U.S. lags behind other developed countries in terms of our life expectancy.
I mentioned the fact that for American Natives and also Alaskan Natives, those numbers were even more precipitous. But I was reading that on reservations that the vaccination rate was relatively high. So what explains that anomaly?
Well, it's these other factors that we're talking about. I mean, we know, for example, that Native Americans have high levels of diabetes and other conditions which probably made them more vulnerable. And those things are themselves rooted in some of these social circumstances. I also want to note that, you know, these inequities are, you know, obviously preceded the pandemic. The life expectancy for Black men is after the pandemic, but, you know, even before the reductions was dramatically lower. For example, it's 67 years.
67 wow.
years wow. in the United States, in a rich country like the United States. So that is quite dramatic. And even, you know, as you noted earlier, you know, the life expectancy for the U.S., the latest numbers in that report is about 76 years. For higher income countries, for these other, you know, 22 kind of peer comparisons, it's in the 80s, in the low 80s. So this shows us that there's something going on at many levels, and that this is a systemic and fundamental social problem that we as a society need to really grapple with.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, do we have the, if not the appetite, the will, the technology, the people, the willingness to actually tackle this huge issue?
Well, I think...
I hope so, but do we?
I think we have technology, we have knowledge, we know a lot of things that we can do. And I think COVID has highlighted this even more and has created a movement to increasingly recognize these factors. I think what we will be able to accomplish depends on, you know, how we address the political challenges in making these things a reality and really prioritizing health and justice, frankly.
And having people willing to go to the voters with that particular message. I mean, we're in another voting season now.
Exactly. I mean, health is intimately linked to the way societies are organized and managed. And I think health and health equity should be a goal of any society, and it needs to be a priority goal so that we can all live full and active and fulfilling lives.
Well, thank you for that message, and thank you for coming in and telling us about this important issue. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And again, that's Ana Diaz-Ruiz. She is Dean and Professor of Epidemiology at Drexel University's Dornsife School of Public Health. Getting our conversation started this morning on Radio Times. We're going to be shifting gears, but only slightly, as we talk about this new COVID booster. We've got winter just a couple months away, how to protect ourselves against the coronavirus. And you can email us, joining our conversation, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. There's a new COVID vaccine redesigned to be more efficient against the Omicron variants, and the CDC Director Rochelle Walensky is telling the public to get the shot. Here she is speaking on MSNBC yesterday.
For the first time now, we have a shot that actually targets exactly the variants that we have circulating right now. So about 88% of our variants are BA5, about 11% BA4. And right now, this updated shot is half the original strain and half that BA4, BA5 strain. What's targeted to that BA4, BA5 strain? The laboratory data suggests that this updated vaccine will perform better against the circulating strains we have right now, that it will perform perform better against other circulating variants that may come, and that it won't sacrifice anything in terms of protection of the original strain. So we're in a much better place with this updated booster right now.
President Biden is scheduled to speak with the White House, from the White House today, reinforcing that message and telling the public that annual coronavirus shots are the likely way to approach this virus, much like annual flu shots. Well, today in Radio Times, what you need to know about this new booster, the latest on COVID, and how to protect yourself from coronavirus that still kills about 400 Americans every day. We have two guests who have joined us. Here in our Philadelphia studios is John Wary. He's director of the Institute of Immunology at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. John Wary, nice to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for having
me. Once again on Radio Times. And Peter Chin Hong joins us from San Francisco. He's an infectious disease physician, also professor of medicine at the University of California. Peter Chin Hong, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me on, Marty.
You're very welcome. And to our, as I mentioned earlier, you can join us, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, John, let me begin with you. What do we need to know about this new booster?
Yeah, well, we're very lucky to be in this position. This new booster now adds in an additional spike protein from the BA.4/5 variant, the variant that's circulating now, as we heard Rachel Walensky say. That's going to give us an additional ability to make antibodies that are more tailored to the strains that are currently circulating. We do know that the original vaccines do a great job at protecting us from severe disease, hospitalization, and death. What we're trying to do is stay current with the vaccine strains and adapt as the circulating strains and adapt as those circulating strains adapt. This is like what we do for the flu vaccine. Any booster you get now is going to increase your protection. The additional protection that you get with this new BA.4/5 booster adds on top of that and hopefully gives you a little bit more specificity to the current strains and as we heard, maybe to strains that might come in the future.
And Peter, just picking up on what John was saying there, should everyone get, from your perspective, should everyone get this booster?
I think at some point, Marty, everyone eligible should get this booster. It is updated. There is a lot of promise, but of course, we don't have a lot of real-world data yet. Everyone above the age of 12 is currently eligible, and I think it is towards we really want to simplify thinking about how we get vaccinated. So now, if you've gotten the first two shots, get at least one booster, as John said, and get the booster that's the new and improved version 2.0.
And if you're in the sort of older set, and I'm looking at you, John, and perhaps you even have some chronic illnesses, go now and get the booster? I mean, is it that sort of level of urgency?
Yeah, I think everyone over 65 should certainly be current on their boosters and recommendations. This is also something to discuss with your doctor. You do want to have some time in between your different exposures, and that's something that we can get into a little bit more. You don't want to get boosted every couple of weeks. You're going to get no benefit. You may not hurt anything, but you're certainly not going to be boosting the immune system the way we'd like. So you want to think about timing. You want to think about your behavioral events,
right,
going into the holidays, for example, travel, for example, and especially want to think about your medical conditions, comorbidities, and risk factors. So it's definitely something that's worth a conversation with your physician.
You mentioned timing. So how much time between boosters is the most effective?
Well, this is something that we've seen a lot of real data for in the literature. We've also heard some advice from both the FDA and the CDC on this. What the science tells us is that 4 to 6 months is a minimum between exposures gives you really optimal boosting of the immune system. The language that was used by the FDA and recommendations by the CDC say at least 2 months. Now, I think that can be a little bit confusing.
Mm-hmm.
You hear scientists saying 4 to 6 months. You hear this from the CDC and the FDA. And I think this boils down to, as Peter said, the importance of getting a booster if you're at risk. So there are times where you'd want to get a booster sooner. If you're immunocompromised, a little bit older, perhaps it makes sense to go a little bit earlier on that boost. And it's, again, something to discuss with your physician. So I think that language wants to keep the options open. But for most people, probably 4 to 6 months between exposures is what you want.
And Peter, do we know how long these boosters last? I mean, maybe it is 4 to 6 months. But is that how we should think about it?
I mean, it all depends, Marty, on what happens with the variant. In many vaccine series like hepatitis B or human papillomavirus, we don't need that many shots constantly. But then with you know, of course, tetanus, we need a booster every few years. So it all depends on what happens with this virus. If BA4 and BA5 stay dominant, and or versions of BA4 and BA5 that don't look too different, we probably would be fine with just getting an annual shot, if at all, because, you know, our T cells and B cells will keep us away from the hospital for many years.
Well, let me pick up on that, because we're getting a message from the CDC and apparently from the White House today that we should begin to think about, you know, annual coronavirus shots. And Peter, you referenced that. Are we there yet in terms of how we should think into the future about how to protect ourselves against this rather wily virus?
It is rather wily, Marty, and I think that I've had a lot of humility for this virus, and you know, all the pundits who predicted things have oftentimes been boom-bazzled by the virus. So I think, you know, there are a few questions, but we are moving towards that area. I think the biggest question is really, what do you put in an annual shot?
Right.
Where do you do surveillance? How well do they work? And are we doing surveillance for new variants in general, like we do for influenza? And of course, like I mentioned, would BA4 and BA5 be supplanted by some variant that has undergone such a big change that our current vaccines may not work as well? So what you might see is that for the general population, maybe an annual shot, but for immune compromised or the elderly, maybe it might be as needed shot, depending on what happens with the virus.
And you were nodding your head vigorously there, John, when Peter was talking about experts and predictions.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more with Peter about staying humble here. We've heard a lot of predictions about where the virus is going to go next and what's going to happen, and we've more often been surprised than have been right. So I think we need to recognize our humility and our ability, our need to have as many tools in the toolbox as possible. And so I like to think about this now as moving to the phase of not being in an emergency response status with new vaccines, new variants, but to be thinking about vaccines and boosters as part of your routine healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that you should be thinking about, whether it's once a year for your sort of average healthy person, or whether it's more frequently if you have medical conditions, to check in. And it's not just about your own immunity. It's about, has the virus changed that's circulating? And do we have any updates to the vaccine? This is not the last update we're going to see. We have a lot of science in the works about improving this vaccine over time, getting better and better. So think about it as a routine part of your healthcare, like checking your cholesterol.
But do you think we have gotten used to, maybe complacent, I don't know if that's too strong a word, but we've gotten used to sort of living with this virus, and so we've let our guard down a little bit.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we need to sort of thread that needle on not being too complacent, but by making it, again, part of our routine healthcare, something that we do think about frequently, but we're not in that emergency response status, which is polarizing, which is difficult to manage and difficult to sustain.
Yeah, do you want to add to that, Peter?
Oh, yes, definitely. You couldn't see me because I'm in San Francisco,
yeah,
but I was also vigorously nodding my head too as John was speaking. I think that idea of complacency really resonates with me, because I think we've become numb by zeros after numbers with deaths and when we look at cases. But do realize that what we're accepting now as a population is that, you know, COVID may come down to something like causing 100,000 or 250,000 deaths a year, which is about 10 times a regular flu season. And that's going to settle down to higher numbers of deaths than diabetes or, you know, community-acquired pneumonia or some kidney diseases. So I think it's important to really, like John said, take stock, step back, and really think about all the tools we have and not become complacent. I think we don't want to become panicked or afraid of the virus, but at the same time, you don't want to just run out and pretend that it's 2019.
I was checking numbers. They range between 400 and 500 a day. I think I checked this morning, it was something like 396 people died yesterday, John, from COVID. People often die in hospitals, so we don't see them. And I remember, certainly, I think we all do, early on in the pandemic when, you know, bodies were being put in refrigerator trucks because we couldn't keep up with the numbers of deaths.
Yeah, this is really extraordinary. And we need to put this in context and really think about it in two levels. As Peter said, this is, you know, currently somewhere in the range of three to five times what we and I'll use this term carefully, what we tolerate as a society for flu deaths per year. And even those flu deaths are an unacceptable burden on society. And our healthcare system really isn't built to handle that. So we need to think about that on multiple levels. The second part of that is the vast majority of those deaths, Marty, are unvaccinated people still.
Okay.
People over 65, the majority of people who are dying are over 65, and this impacts the conversation in the previous segment about changes in lifespan in the U.S. But a lot of these deaths are still preventable. And the part of this that makes it even more remarkable is over 65, we have a very, very high vaccination rate.
It's in the 90s, isn't
exactly.
It?
That means that even though that denominator is getting very, very full of fully vaccinated people, most of the deaths are still occurring in those who are unvaccinated. And what that does is it tells you that vaccines really work, especially in that population. There are comorbidities. Immunocompromised people have disproportionate morbidity here and things. But it really just sort of highlights the power of vaccination and keeping up with your health care in this way.
Well, picking up on that, Peter, and I mean, there have been probably muddled messages, but messages coming from the government, coming from CDC, FDA, from physicians, from health care people, public health people to get a vaccination. We're at about, 65% of adults that have it. Is there anything more that can be done to get closer to herd immunity, if such a thing exists?
Well, I think many of folks have dispensed with the notion of herd immunity as a concept, but rather I think in concept it is. We are getting stronger and stronger as a community as we get these successive waves of infection come through and people are getting vaccinated and boosted, et cetera. But yes, I mean, I think messaging has been confusing. I think that it's really tough as a general person to keep up with how many boosters should I get? And is it 4 months? Is it 5 months? And now they're saying I can get the new booster 2 months after. So people are getting a lot of confusion. And I think in part, that's the reason why there was a statement on Tuesday about the potential of an annual shot is to really simplify the message right. And make people have a more palatable intervention. And as Ashish Jha said, sort of quipped, God gave us two arms, one for the flu shot and one for the COVID shot once a year. I think it's been a tough 2.5 years in terms of keeping up with how the virus has evolved.
Well, here's a related question from Melanie. She says, what's the recommended timing for getting these shots for shingles, for flu, for COVID? Can I toss that back to you, John Murray?
Yeah, and I'll make sure that the licensed infectious disease physician Weiss in here,
we
too.
We won't forget you, Peter.
But we do want to think about these things as yearly vaccines. So shingles, certainly at the age of 50, make sure you get your shingles vaccine. For flu, we want to be up to date on our flu vaccines yearly. And I do think we're headed towards some version of that simplicity for these COVID vaccines as well. It's important to remember that these vaccines, even 3 doses, are doing a remarkably good job at decreasing morbidity and mortality in otherwise healthy people. They're doing great. Most vaccines, and this is an important thing to say very, very clearly, most vaccines protect you from disease, not necessarily from infection. But most of the time, those infections are what we call subclinical. So the flu vaccine every year decreases morbidity and mortality. It doesn't necessarily completely prevent a mild infection. And those mild infections, we never know because we don't diagnose them. The same is true here for these COVID vaccines, except that we've never looked harder for a virus in people. We can all test at home. We all know when we've got a breakthrough infection. We all complain about it, but yet we're sitting on our couch at home watching reruns, feeling a little bit bad, but not in the hospital. We recover and we go back to work. So it's really important to make that distinction.
And Peter, do you want to add to the timing of all these various vaccines and how people should think about that?
Yeah, so I mean, I think I'm echoing something that John said earlier, which is, it's just think about who you are. I think if you're older than 65, if you are immune compromised, you should go out and get it sooner rather than later. If you're more than 2 months, 2 months from your last one, although many people in that category have had their last one many months prior. But if you're somebody else who is younger, say younger than 50, have no medical problems, you might sort of watch the graph and try to time it like you do the flu vaccine. So if we think a surge is coming in the winter. For example, I get my flu shot in October because I want my antibodies to kind of peak where influenza is peaking, mm-hmm. which is December, January, February. If I get it too early, I might miss the boat. So, you know, that's the way to think about it.
And Peter, you both sort of rolled your eyes when talking about predicting some of these things, but I was reading that there are some predictions that flu season could be a little worse this year. Do you sign on to that?
Oh, yeah, totally. I know we've cried wolf for the last 2 years about flu coming back with a vengeance and the twindemic, et cetera. But I think we've seen that in Australia, New Zealand, Brazil, Argentina, places that have had their winters now, they've really had more flu than even 2019. So I think both from a decrease in population immunity as well as not being as good with predicting what's going to be in flu, we are destined for more flu than we've seen before.
And about a minute before our break here, John, go ahead and add to that.
Yeah, I agree completely. This is also something that we have to remember. I think the decrease in immunity from the last 3 years of both flu vaccination, because people have delayed healthcare, and also exposure to flu, combined with strains we may not have predicted as well, and changing behavior going into this fall. We're not masking anymore. Are going to lead to an increase in flu.
And I do want to talk about masking, but I again, you know, one can just see people are not wearing masks the way they were a year ago.
And masks prevent flu just like they prevent COVID.
So is the message then, if you're out in public, if you're in public transportation, if you're at the movies, if you're at a restaurant, a little harder at a restaurant, wear a mask?
Yeah, I think your risk tolerance should guide some of this. And thinking about the risky behaviors and risky environments, we've now learned a lot about that. So think about your risk tolerance, your risk of your own health care and other medical conditions, and wear masks where you think you might get exposed to viruses.
Well, we're going to take that short break and then get back to our conversation. We are getting the latest on COVID, talking about this booster that was just announced. Winter is coming, and that often leads to greater risk for things like flu and the coronavirus. Talking with John Wary, he's director of the Institute for Immunology at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. Peter Chin Hong joining us from San Francisco. He's infectious disease physician, professor of medicine at the University of California at San Francisco. And again, any questions or comments, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, we're getting an update on COVID. There's a new booster that is available tailored to this Omicron variants. And again, talking with John Wary from the University of Pennsylvania and Peter Chin Hong from the University of California. And you can always call us with any questions or comments. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Peter, John and I have a slight advantage over you in that we can talk during the break. And I just, he and I were talking about the difference between infection and disease, something he said on the air. But I just want to make sure our listeners really understand that difference there, because I think it's led to a fair amount of confusion for us non-medical people. Go ahead,
yes,
John.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, well, go ahead, Peter, and then we'll get John in, but go ahead.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, as an infectious disease physician, I see this all the time and the confusion, and I've definitely seen it during COVID. But to me, infection is basically any time a pathogen that's not a normal part of your body lands on you, you can diagnose it. But the disease it causes is a response of your body to this pathogen, either usually in an aberrant way. And one example, I think it's better to sure. illustrate by examples. Certainly in human papillomavirus, you can get you can do a swab and develop and find out that you have a high-risk virus or a HPV type. But it only causes disease when you see a clinical wart or it causes a precancer lesion. So that's the difference between just finding the virus when you're looking for molecular methods and having disease like a wart or a precancer lesion.
And just picking up on that and going back to you, John, one hears of people who got the vaccine, who got boosted and got COVID, then the conclusion being, well, then maybe the vaccine didn't work. But that's not the truth.
That's right. And I hear this all the time anecdotally, and we've certainly seen this in lay press and even scientific press, that people get the vaccine, then get a breakthrough infection, and they're at home symptomatic, I'll call it. And you can feel pretty crummy, even though you're vaccinated. But what's happening behind the scenes is your B cells and T cells, which are not going to prevent the initial infection, but they come raging on board very quickly. They stop the virus, usually in your upper respiratory tract, so you basically get a head cold, and prevent the virus from spreading around your body. So you might have symptoms, and as Peter said, these may be a combination of the virus and your immune response, but you're not in the hospital, you're not in the ICU, you're not dying. And we have to remember back to mid-2020, when even people in their 30s and 40s, otherwise healthy, were filling the ICUs and were filling the morgues. We're not having that, and that's because of this kind of immunity that prevents disease but doesn't necessarily completely prevent infection. Mm-hmm. Now, we may see going forward newer types of vaccines that do a better job of giving us local immunity in the upper respiratory tract, in your nose or nasal passages. And it's one reason why we need to think about this as a yearly check-in with your doctor, not just about your own immunity, mm-hmm. but about what else has come down the vaccine pipeline.
You know, I'm thinking, and I'll put this to you, Peter, then we got a lot of comments here. The president and the first lady both got COVID, recovered, and then a couple of days later got COVID. And I've heard, frankly, just anecdotally, a couple of other people in my life that something true to that. Does that tell us anything about this virus or people's ability to fight it off?
I mean, yes. I mean, I think, first of all, in the case of the president and Jill Biden, they underwent surveillance for virus, even though they didn't have any symptoms. So I think that is not what we would normally do in the community. So I think that was by itself abnormal. It's different from somebody who sort of like got better and then, okay, then they got that sore throat again, and then you're going to swab them. But again, with somebody without any symptoms, I'm not really sure what that means. But it does tell us that we know that even people not on therapy, that they can get recurrent symptoms with COVID. And we don't really understand what it means necessarily. And I think, again, it reflects humility about the virus. And maybe at some point we need to treat some people for longer because they're feeling symptoms before a certain amount of viral load in the body, and we're capturing that earlier, or we just need to extend the tail of treatment.
Yeah, and is Paxlovid, is that treatment?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Sorry, John.
Go ahead. Sorry, Peter. Paxlovid is the antiviral treatment here, and I think, as Peter's pointing out, some people may need to take a longer course. Mm-hmm. You can think about this like getting your antibiotics, right? So your doctor tells you, please finish all the antibiotics even if you feel better. Because if you stop too early, the bacteria come back. Mm-hmm. And with Paxlovid, maybe, we're still learning. And so it may be that 5 days of treatment wasn't enough to really purge all of the virus from the body. You stop, and some people, that little bit of virus comes back. So maybe we need an 8-day or a 10-day course. And that's in trials now.
And Peter, I hear it tastes terrible.
Yes, it does taste terrible. But that taste goes away, that terrible taste goes away completely after you stop taking the medicine. It leaves this bitter sort of metallic taste.
Here's a bunch of questions rather related about timing of boosters. Karen says, my family received our second booster this July. How long should we wait before getting this new booster? Or we are 65 years old and one person is immunocompromised. Peter, can I toss that to you first?
Yes, so if Karen and her family got the last booster in July, August, September, this month, September, the end of the month, or October will be a good time. Again, with somebody who's older and 65 and immune compromised, I wouldn't necessarily wait. I'd be proactive rather than reactive. And that's why I would advise Karen and her family to go ahead and get that new booster.
Here's Stu who asks, if I recently had shingles, can I get the booster?
Yes, definitely. The idea of having shingles would not be a contraindication for getting this booster or any COVID vaccine either.
Here's an email from Jonathan. I contracted COVID 6 weeks ago. I'm fine now. I have a booster shot scheduled for today. Should I proceed or wait more time before getting my booster? Can I toss that to you, John?
Yeah, I think we need to know a little bit more about Peter's age and other medical conditions. So I'd encourage him to talk to his doctor. 6 weeks after being infected is a little bit early. Mm-hmm. Those antibodies from infection are still very high in your blood, and those antibodies can interfere with how effectively you boost your memory B and T cells that are underneath those antibodies.
Oh.
So important to know a little bit more before giving Peter direct advice, but a longer time frame might be useful here.
So we do get, if you get COVID, you get, I guess, an advantage of getting some immunity from having...
Sure. I never want to advise someone to get their immunity from infection because there are a lot of risks of infection, even if you're vaccinated. But infection will boost all of these immune responses as well. We know it boosts your antibodies, and those antibodies have characteristics that are similar to what you see following vaccination.
And Peter, here's Patricia, who says, I haven't had a booster in 9 months. How long does it take after getting this new one to get the increased immunity?
Yeah, so most people say at least, 2 weeks on average, but probably in you can get it as early as 1 week after. So that's why for Olin 65 and immune compromise, like my chair, Bob Wachter, says, you can't really know when the next surge is coming. It's like the stock market. So you want to be, again, go ahead and get that just because it takes that lag time to really get the maximal benefit.
I was reading, and China does these, and I'm looking at you, John, where China does these lockdowns, mm-hmm. to try to address the problem of the pandemic in that country with the goal of eradicating, as I understand it, the idea is to sort of rid their country of COVID. Does that make any sense?
The short answer is no.
No.
No. This virus isn't going away, and lockdowns are not the solution. When our hospitals were overwhelmed and we were worried about not being able to treat other patients, we had to have some mitigation to keep our hospitals open to deal with car accident victims and heart attack victims. Right now, lockdowns don't seem to make a lot of sense either virologically, epidemiologically, or in terms of public health.
How about for you, Peter? How do you see that?
Yes, definitely. I don't think that lockdowns will work. Certainly against Omicron flavors. They sort of mitigated it early on when it was harder to get, but at this point, the horse is already out of the barn, and I'm worried about China for several reasons. The first is that it's not going to work, and a lot of people are suffering because they're not getting access to healthcare. And then number two, when COVID gets there, it's going to be devastating because a lot of their seniors have not had the booster shots. So I'm worried about a repeat of what happened in Hong Kong with Omicron earlier this year.
And that's Peter Chin Hong. He's an infectious disease physician who joins us along with John Wary, director of the Institute of Immunology at the University of Pennsylvania, getting an update on COVID, answering your questions. And again, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. John, I remember doing our last COVID show, and I asked our guest, what if you've never gotten COVID? And there are people who have never gotten COVID. I don't think I've gotten COVID, but you said me neither.
Nope.
Should we be studied to try to figure out how we have been able to, and I'm out in the world, as I'm sure you are as well. So are we good specimens for some kind of research?
Well, I think we need a lot more research in general here. And so absolutely, people who have never gotten COVID and seem to have been living their life like others have who have gotten COVID, those who have gotten COVID many, many times, we do know that there are certain both background, say genetic, and even background non-genetic features of the immune system that change the way we respond to SARS-CoV-2 infection. We're starting to see some hints about how important some of those are, their links to long COVID perhaps, their links to severe outcomes. But I would say, Marty, we're very early in really understanding this. And this is a very interesting opportunity to learn more about the human immune system and how the human immune system diversity impacts disease outcomes, perhaps than we've ever had before.
As an infectious disease physician, Peter, what would you like to know about the people who haven't gotten COVID?
I think John said it really beautifully. For me, it just really has echoes of other infections that I've seen some people with the same exposure don't get. And we certainly know that in HIV, for example, and John would be much better, more adapted at describing it than I would. You know, there are people with mutations in receptors where the virus binds to the cell that it's infecting that makes it inhospitable for binding, so that those kinds of genetic signals can help us not only understand why some people are getting it and some don't, but for us to develop drugs that exploit that understanding.
Fred asked, do you think getting vaccinated could have any impact on the potential for long COVID? And it seems to me long COVID is very worrisome, John.
Yeah, long COVID is still something that we should be talking more about. Vaccination definitely reduces your risk of long COVID. The numbers on long COVID are still a little bit gray. We've had changing definitions over time, but I think most of the data says now that the percent of people with long COVID after infection is somewhere around 10%, maybe plus or minus 2 or 3. Vaccination seems to reduce that probably by 30 to 40%. But long COVID can really be devastating. It can really be life-altering in people who really have severe neurological or other kinds of effects. So it's certainly something we want to be aware of. We need to study it a lot more, but we also need to think about it as one of the major things we're reducing by vaccination.
Yeah. And Peter, do you want to add to that? It's such an important issue.
Yeah. I mean, I really resonate with what John has said. And in terms of, you know, one of the key papers a few months ago really spoke about four factors that predict long COVID or chronic symptoms. They include, reactivation of EBV or another virus, autoantibodies that you develop, diabetes. But the most important factor for me, which is reversible, I think, is virus in your blood. So if you get things that kick the virus out of your bloodstream faster, it may impact that, which is vaccination boosting and early therapy, even if you're unvaccinated. But yes, like John said, there'll be millions of people, in this country alone who already have been taken out of the workforce and the schools because of these symptoms. And the U.S. government has put in $500 million so far to try to understand this, but it's probably not going to be enough.
Yeah. I'm looking at the clock here, and I do want to talk a bit about children and vaccinations. I'm looking at you, John Weary. I don't have the exact number for teenagers, but I know it's less than it should be. I do believe, I was checking from 6 months to 4 years old, less than 10% of toddlers and babies have had this vaccine. Is it parental concern about the impact on a young child? What's the holdup?
I think there are a variety of factors, right? The vaccines for this age group have become available later when we were in a different phase of the pandemic. We do have some parental concerns and I'll call it vaccine hesitancy, which are real, right? Sure. We have to engage and really make sure we're addressing some of those concerns. And that's coupled with the risks in kids being lower than adults. And that's true too. But that belies like the challenges of having even a single kid who dies from COVID. It's preventable. It's vaccine preventable. We still do have children ending up in the hospital, in the ICU, and dying of COVID. The numbers are certainly lower than adults, but these are things that we can prevent. Also, vaccinating kids who are healthy can also impact and help protect those kids in their classes who can't be vaccinated or can't make a good response to vaccines.
And Peter, about 30 seconds. I mean, children are now back in school, so, fingers crossed that they can make it through the school year without closures.
Exactly, and that's another reason to have them as protected as possible, to really keep them in the seats as long as we can, and to really give them an insurance policy for the future. You know, we focus on the present for COVID, but a lot of it is for the long game, and please vaccinate the kids.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us on Radio Times. Very helpful information. Peter Chin Hong, thanks for getting up early there in San Francisco and joining us here in Philadelphia.
My pleasure. So great to be on with you.
Well, thank you so much. And he's an infectious disease physician, professor of medicine at the University of California in San Francisco. John Wary joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And he is director of the Institute for Immunology, Institute for Immunology at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. Well, to replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs, and you can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. It takes us about an hour to get them up and running. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.